Okay, we'll go ahead and get started. So this is our third Rules Advisory Committee meeting for Oregon Common Credentialing Program Rules, credentialing rules in general. There's a little telemedicine mixed in there from years past. Today we'll go over our latest iteration of the rule. We got some DOJ comments. Unfortunately, we just got them yesterday. So there's a quick turnaround. So we made some adjustments, and that's what we sent out this morning. And I'm not sure if they got posted to the website yesterday. Yes, they did. Okay, awesome. So folks can follow along there. So I guess what we'll do is highlight what those changes are, and we can discuss them as folks feel they want to, or I think in addition to what we'll do is allow you guys a few weeks to process those. So I think before our next advisory group meeting for common credentialing, which is we want to do our notice of proposed rulemaking by July 12th. That is our end goal. So what we would like to do, I think, is get any comments from you by the end of this month, so June 30th, on this iteration of the rules, and that would be helpful. And that way we can pass it through the advisory group that first week of July, assuming people are actually in the office for the 4th of July. and go So we'll go around the room. This is Melissa DeVoren, Oregon Health Authority, and I will pass the rest to you.
Amy, Healthcare of Oregon.
Mark Bonanno, Oregon Medical Association.
Kristen Downey, Providence.
Ivan Kulis, OHA.
Luke Woloski, OHA.
And those on the phone?
Julie McCann, Pacific Source.
Ann Klinger, Providence Health Plan.
Danielle Coates, Quality Healthcare.
I got Bill. Hi, Bill.
Hello.
Been a while. Who else was on the line? I heard Danielle, Bill.
Somebody? Melanie Cook and Karen Dugan from Asante.
Hi, guys. Kane Lau and Linda Follen from Kaiser.
Hattie Krabby Regents.
This is Rebecca Popstock with the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems.
And Amy Lyons, Legacy Health.
Okay. Anyone else? And just a reminder, our last public meeting, somebody put us on hold. We had hold music, so I just want to throw that out there. If you want to put the phone down, just push mute, and we'll be there when you come back. housekeeping, I guess. Okay, so again, we just want to highlight what the latest iteration of these rule changes contain, and then we can allow you until June 30th to provide comments. What I would suggest is if you're providing comments via email is you copy the entire group, so that way the entire group has an opportunity to absorb and comment on your comments. So I think that will be helpful, and again, we can discuss whatever we would like to in relation to the rule today as you see necessary. That said, I think we can jump right into it. There were several comments and questions that we had for the Department of Justice that related to multiple sections in here. We are still having an issue with how we define health system and also the provider directory component. So the directory related data is also still a little bit of a concern. The other big piece we plugged in here was fees. So I'll give you an opportunity to check that out. So starting from the beginning and definition, one thing that we had never identified is what a designee is, and I think somebody had brought that up. So we created a definition for it, and that is at the bottom of page 1. Designee means an individual a healthcare practitioner designates to assist in completing requirements set forth in Section 55, and that's the healthcare practitioner participation section. comments on that? Okay. Hi, Nicole. Nicole's just in the room. We are on just on definitions. I mentioned that we got DOJ commentary yesterday, so we've incorporated some of that, and we still have some questions to work through them. So it's kind of a quick turnaround, so we'll offer the opportunity for folks to do email to the entire group if they have comments between now and June 30th, so that we can incorporate those and provide them to the advisory group.
Okay. Thank you.
So we just looked at designees, and I have no comments there that we've received, so we'll move on to the bottom of page 2. Health system meaning was adjusted, and this is still something that we need to have a little bit of a more directed dialogue with the Department of Justice here, but essentially, health system means an organization that delivers health care through affiliated hospitals, facilities, or clinics that are under common control or ownership. I would say that my issue with that language is that that could include an organization that has a service relationship with any hospital, facility, or clinic that is under common control or ownership. So it could be any organization that's affiliated with, say, Legacy, and so then Legacy would actually be under that health system. I think there's some gaps for me here, and I don't know if anybody had any comments on that.
What's the goal? Like, what are you, like, not talking about specific language, but in OHA or your head, how do you see health system defined? Not with legal terms, but just, like, loosely or casually.
Well, what our goal was is, again, health system wasn't defined anywhere.
Yeah.
And so what we talked about internally is it would include the delivery system component. But we want to make sure that affiliations is too much of a loose term, because you can just have a contractual relationship that involves some type of monetary reimbursement, right, that's just for services. So you're not actually owned, you're not actually centralizing any of your processes in relation to credentialing. And really, that's what I would like to reward. I would say if you are using the system in a centralized capacity right now, you should reap the benefit of being able to be in a collective tier, et cetera, and getting that kind of economies of scale discount, because you are already trying to operate at an efficient level. What the concern is, though, is it's all my same business. I just happen to have 4 credentialing committees or 5 or however many, and they're all making a decision. And in other, there's precedents in other credentialing, I guess, tools, like the National Practitioner Data Bank. It's based on the decision. So it's based on your use. You're pulling the information and doing a credentialing activity here. You're pulling the information, doing a credentialing activity at this other location. So it's actually being used multiple times. And that's a tax on the system. And so that's where I see it in one light, but I also see it in the respect that there are these organizations, it's all the same, and we should give bulk discount. And essentially, you are getting a bulk discount in a higher tier, and that's what we push through. But enable to allow us to be in concert with the statute, and it's saying that health system is, it doesn't say it explicitly, but it's in legislative testimony. So the intent was to that health systems were a separate kind of organization. So we've had to really look at it in that respect. And so that's why we can define health system and we consider it the delivery. There's arguments on both sides. Does a health plan that's affiliated with a delivery system, is that included? And we're looking at those as integrated delivery networks. This is a lot of information, I know. it's important to the conversation. And so that's why, you know, we've defined health system. We're still having an issue with, and internally, again, we need to go back to DOJ and you know, look at that interpretation. But apart from even that health system is how do we look at integrated delivery networks, because if they're bringing both health system and the health plan, do they get a discount? And there are, there's the Emergency Department of Information Exchange where they do that for integrated delivery network. If you want a health system, and that's, you know, considering the delivery component of it, and you want a health plan, then you get a discount on both sides. We're looking at that. We're looking at the health system, but it's not, you know, OHA wants to be cognizant of the different unique aspects of those types of organizations, and so we're working with the Hospital Association and the Oregon Health Leadership Council to make sure that we have the right conversations to the right people to understand all those unique situations and their interplay here.
Businesses you're talking about, like a payer or contractor type relationship. Are there other relationships that are outside of payer or contractor?
No. Well, there's payer.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
So you can be a health plan. Like Samaritan has several different plans. And I don't think that they actually centralize their credentialing committee there for the plans. I think they might. But there could be a payer-to-payer relationship. And then there's, the way we see it is affiliations are very hard to get at. So it would have to be self-reported in some way. But there could be health plans and hospitals, ambulatory surgical centers, medical practices, so clinics that have hospital own them. There's a number of different kind of scenarios. So it's a little bit challenging for us to work through that, and certainly we need that outside perspective, those folks that are on the ground in those relationships. But again, affiliation, to me, is a very loose term.
I would...
Melissa, this is Melanie Cookman. I wonder if, is it, forgive me if this has already been vetted previously, but I wonder if we could include in that definition a phrase that said utilizing or making credentialing decisions centrally.
Right, so there's a piece to that later on in the definition, as the health system will have to identify all their affiliated organizations, but it's affiliated credentialing organizations, so essentially that's identifying that they're a credentialing organization. I wonder if in the credentialing organization definition, though, is where we might want to define, throw in a little bit of language as to what it means to really credential someone making a decision and whatnot. Because right now what we have is a separate crosswalk that we haven't even publicized, really. But it just says you are, I think we brought it to a meeting before for the advisory group, so it's very new meeting materials on our website, but basically you're our credentialing organization. If you acknowledge that you're credentialed practitioners, you're mandated to credential practitioners, you have a credentialing committee, you make decisions to credential practitioners. So there's like these four components or so. Your thoughts on that, Melanie?
I would love to see those criteria for how to define a credentialing organization, although that's completely aligned with what most my understanding of it, but I like that idea of tying it into the other section.
Kristen, did you have any? No, I can search out for that crosswalk too, but I think that, yeah, figuring out a way to tie them together would be interesting. My only other kind of thing to raise would be, I don't know who within the Hospital Association or OHLC you guys are working with, but that doesn't always mean that it's going out in a comprehensive way and getting vetted. So making sure that either to the RAC or to, there's so many different smaller work groups with this work too, that we have a chance to at least provide some input.
Right. Okay. Yeah, so our idea is to start with the Hospital Association and a few folks on the Oregon Health Leadership Council, especially their admin SIM groups, Aaron Doolin, who's also part of our advisory group, and then Greg Van Pelt, who manages the OHLC stuff. And then the Hospital Association, we have their policy team, so Rebecca Pollack is on the phone right now. So she's involved in that. Annie Easton and Danielle Myers and Sean Comer has been a part of the conversation as well. Also from the admin then is from your organization is Stephanie Dreyfus. We talk to her occasionally. So I think as we work out kind of what the scenarios and options and details are, then we can bring them back to these groups. And then have a more involved conversation so that we're all on the same page. So it's good to flag the reminders that there are so many groups and bringing the information down.
And this is Rebecca with the Hospital Association. We have our own sort of internal process for vetting it with our association board, and then we'll be doing some broader communication. I think it's tough for us because we also don't know what exact perfect definition would be, and we want it to be pretty specific to credentialing. Broadly and generally, we're a little weary of having a definition of health system sort of in rule anywhere. So we're watching this piece pretty closely.
Right. I think that's a good point.
If that helps.
That's helpful for me, even.
Yeah.
Having those conversations with you guys. But thinking about that health system definition, there was actually some legislation that had actually, I have it written down somewhere, that basically said a health system is any corporation that owns at least one hospital. And that's super broad. And I was like, that's not going to work for our definition. And so I was thinking about, containing it in this rule, so maybe at the end of the definition, saying for purposes of this rule. So thinking about that moving forward, that's a good thing to flag. And I commented on that legislation to several folks. I never followed through to see what they did with it.
Yeah, again, this is Rebecca. There's been several attempts this session and last session to define health system for various policy purposes, and it always gets very complicated. And so as specific as we can be, and if it doesn't need to have anything describing financial ownership, if it is more about centralized services or centralized business lines, that's a direction that we could talk about, but I'm still too learning about all of the different ways our health systems are configured, and it is really challenging. If you get too specific, you're not including everyone. If you're overly broad, then people can exempt themselves in different ways, and so, looking forward to the conversation.
Yeah, I'm curious to know if you guys have ever taken a stab at a definition or just, been wanting to remain neutral.
We broadly use affiliation, and that's why I understand your concerns about that, because it is broad. But, an example of, like, Samaritan, there are five or six hospitals within that affiliated, system. But then one of their hospitals is actually still pretty independent, owned by a health district, but they're still centralized in the system. And so there's just different configurations, legacy. There's different ways that they report their, even to the IRS, how they're configured, and it's whatever works best for them. And we don't want to put in any policy that's overly prescriptive. So. We can keep looking at it. We usually say affiliation, and it's mostly with hospital to hospital. We don't really go to the sub-hospital level, so if they are affiliated with an ASC or a other clinics, you know, from the association's perspective, it's how our hospitals, licensed hospitals, affiliated with each other, and that's sort of where we stop our defining, I guess you could say.
Okay. That's interesting. Okay. Thank you for that. Any other comments on that? I think that's a little bit of helpful information to help our conversation. Still more to come. All right, moving forward, if we look at page 5, credentialing organizations shall, I moved up the section from the B section that had to do with how folks started to pay, and I basically just put the payment requirements for organizations and practitioners in their respective sections. We have credentialing organization participation here, and then we have a section later for healthcare practitioner participation. So I identified, you know, how they have to pay fees, but then I identified in the fees section what the fees are. So I hope that makes a little more sense. So credentialing organization shall, as we look at number 3 at the top of page 5, pay a one-time setup fee at initial enrollment in the program. And then B is pay an annual subscription fee to the authority based on healthcare practitioner panel size at initial enrollment in the program and every year thereafter. Identify identify healthcare practitioner panel size using a full count of its credentialed healthcare practitioners, in which a decision to credential the healthcare practitioner is made by the credentialing organization. That brings in a little bit of that decision component. Yeah.
Melissa, it's Ann. So I'm just trying to clarify on this one. Is this where if you have the multiple hospitals, but the decision is made at just the governing body, you know, everybody else recommends up to the one governing body, so they get to count it the one time at the governing body level?
Correct. That's how this is written.
Thank you.
Okay, and then D, we have not included their healthcare practitioner panel size, fully delegated healthcare practitioners in which a decision is made by a separate credentialing organization. So this is that roster scenario, again, where you're delegating the full credentialing to someone, some other organization.
Melissa, this is Danielle.
Yes.
I have a question. When it says identify and I guess my question is who's identifying? The program, the hospital?
Credentialing organization.
Do we have to specify that they're the ones identifying their panel size?
So it says, so it starts out number 3, credentialing organizations shall identify healthcare practitioner panel size. Do you think something more specific is necessary there?
No, that's, I guess going back to that's probably fine. I guess I just, because the program's not going to, is the program going to, like, double check your numbers? Like, is there any, like, we're just solely going on the honor system?
So that's a good question. Essentially, yes, for the first 3 years. What we talked about is that after a year, the system could then identify who's really on your panel. And we don't know if we will have a full count by the time a year rolls around, like who's connected with your organization and whatnot. So I think at this point you're identifying and we can try to do a reconciliation, but we haven't really defined how we would look at compliance in that sense.
Okay, thanks.
So, Melissa, when you talk about the reconciling, you're talking about the question we asked probably at rulemaking number one was, what do we, you know, do we have to pay the fees when not all our providers are enrolled in the system?
Right. And so that's essentially it. We need where our adoption rate that we're looking at is 90% of those practitioners. It'll be partly the responsibility of the organizations to move all their practitioners in, and then you would have all the continuous monitoring on those folks as well. So if they're in, they're in there for the whole year, we're doing the continuous monitoring. And so that's the idea. In the first year, yes, there will be some uptake issues in terms of can we get all 90% in there. We think we can if we have everybody working toward that goal. But that is definitely a concern.
Well, you would think if the healthcare regulatory boards are participating at the very beginning, you're going to get all the licensed practitioners in the database anyway. You just wouldn't have the practitioner's application, correct?
Right. The only issue with that, there would still be a disconnect in terms of the practitioners still would have to come in to identify which organizations their information should belong to.
Right.
So that would be the gap. And so, you know, what I would do at this point is this is the way the rule should be written. But there is that caveat that there might be a disconnect at the end of the year. So the question needs to go back to OHA in terms of what do we do if the number that you identify for us is significantly different than what we have at the end of the first year.
And you don't want to put that language in here? Or something to the effect of?
I think that's a question for the agency. So that's what I'll bring, is what do we do at the year? And if we do some kind of reconciliation, then I think we would want to put it in the rule. If it's just a one-year thing, then maybe we don't want to put it in the rule. And if something we do, so I think it's an internal conversation that we need to have, so it's just flagged up. We don't want to give people money back. It's a joke. It's a joke. On record.
You can credit us. Issue us a gift card, too.
I wish it was on free. Okay. So I'm making that note. All right. Anything else on that at this point? Okay. So again, the health system conversation that is still being worked out in here. I wanted to point out that a health system shall maintain a list of all affiliated or owned credentialing organizations. And so there is some kind of question as to if we say a health system includes medical groups and they are not credentialing, they might still think they have to be in the system. But this piece, the DOJ basically said that if we say health systems identify their financially owned or affiliated, whatever, credentialing organizations, then that's stating that if you're, it's making the connection that if you're a medical group that's owned by a health system and you don't credential, you don't have to be listed as affiliated for that purpose. Cookstown County.
Do you repeat that? If you're a medical group or you're not, I need a clarification.
So there is some concern that health systems include, in our definition, hospitals, ambulatory, surgical centers, medical groups. And if you look at that as a medical group, you might assume that I'm a credentialing organization because I'm clearly named in here. But the idea is that the only medical groups that would be in this rule and be considered a credentialing organization if they are doing the actual credentialing. There are some medical groups that have assumed they do credentialing because they participate in the credentialing process, but they're not making decisions. They're just helping facilitate the practitioners to get credentials, but they're not actually doing the credentialing. In some cases, they are, but it's less so rather than the majority.
Okay, thanks.
This is Nicole. This isn't my area of expertise by any means, but I'm trying to understand. It seems like it's a little bit circular because I thought that trying to define health system was so that we could call them one credentialing organization. Is that correct or incorrect?
They're a credentialing organization type.
Okay. Because then to provide a list of all credentialing organizations within the health system seems like, are they one or are they multiple? I thought they were trying to be one so that they could benefit from the higher tier.
Right.
And yet, if you're saying that they're composed of credentialing organizations, it seems just a little circular to me, so I'm just trying to
And I'll explain that. Yes, that is true. But the reason why we're doing it that way is because we want all those credentialing organizations to enter into the system separately. How the billing and the tier works is why we're identifying who's under whom. And the reason for that is we want to make sure that practitioners, when they come in, they may not know that that medical group or that ambulatory surgical center is owned by a certain entity. And so it would be hard for them to identify that in the system unless we made expensive system changes to where we could link all of them up electronically. And we talked about a number of different ways we could do that, but all of them were more costly system fixes and the cost is high enough.
And so then is the, for example, physician going in and clicking all of the different organizations
right.
that they're credentialed with, I feel like maybe they wouldn't know who all they're credentialed with because of that very idea of if I'm credentialed with Legacy, I might not realize that I also need to pick Randall Children's Hospital and Good Samaritan Hospital and all of those others. I think it gets a little tricky for them. They don't necessarily know who all their credentials are.
Right, and that's a good point, too. And I think thinking about, I'm going to point to maybe Melanie and also Anne, when they're like Providence Medical Group, actually, when they're credentialing folks, I think a number of they have to be credentialed with or privileged with a couple of hospitals, or they at least participate on one hospital's panel. But maybe in some cases, and maybe in South Providence, it's Samaritan, but they're automatically pushed to the other organization. So you're right, there may be some unknowns on the practitioner's behalf, but then one organization is going to have to support their whole organization in coordinating that, and that wouldn't be the job of the system. And hopefully the practitioner is aware where they're credentialed because they explicitly have to give permission to send their information there.
Yeah, Melissa, I think for Providence, it's Anne, that because they're employed physicians, and so they pretty much, I think they know where they go because not actually all of those employed physicians are on the hospital, but they are on the health plan.
Right, but then in a lot of cases you're going to have a designee that's going to say you're going to need to go and sign up for this one, that one, and the other.
Yes, Yeah. They have that at, yeah, at Providence Medical, yeah, at PMG, yes.
Because this is Bill Donlan. I'm just going to relate a story. I don't know how it broadly applies, but this is true. My optometrist was asked by the VA to see patients that are too far away from the whatever facility. Where I'm in Southern Oregon, where they have to go for obtaining eye care. And because he's an optometrist in a single office by himself, they said, well, you have to be credentialed. And he was like, well, I don't, I'm me. I have my own practice. I have 3 employees, and I'm it. I don't have credential. I credential me. And I don't think he's alone in being somebody who is in a situation where you're kind of in a situation where you're self-credentialed. Are we considering that at all?
No, because in that instance, that's not credentialed. But to the extent that optometrist...
But he wants to be reimbursed by the VA, he has to have
right.
a credential.
Right, because then he's treating...
Which the state is going to be assuming. So how does somebody in that situation get credentialed through the state of Oregon under what we're trying to do here?
Yeah, and actually the VA has been exempt, but there's an important
I can pick other examples, but that's just one I happen to know is a true story.
Right, and I think that there's an important distinction there, and I'll tell you that. And someone that treats patients that they are getting reimbursed for, so if it's not a private payer, most practitioners are going to need to be credentialed by someone. Someone who's paying them, someone who's allowing them to treat their patients that are on their payroll.
Maybe most, but not all.
There could be some. There are some. Right,
oh, there's some. I guarantee you, there are more than just like some.
Hi, this is Melanie from the Fonte. I think Karen and I were just reflecting that the nomenclature gets really tricky, even just the word credentialing. So there's, when someone requests credentialing, sometimes they mean membership or enrollment or privileges. And
right.
those terms get overlapping under the umbrella of the word credentialing.
Right. Yep, that is an important distinction as well, because you're right. I think, you know, when we were looking at the system and trying to think of do we track the credentialing decision, there was a lot of confusion with, well, just because they're credentialed doesn't mean they're enrolled. And so it's, you know, what kind of engagement does the practitioner have that can certainly make that confusing. And credentialing is a very, you know, like I said, a very loose definition as well. So if you have any more very descriptive thoughts as to how we can best define credentialing, I guess now's the time to do it since we're in the rules.
I don't remember the number of the regulation, but it's credentialing has already been defined.
Mm-hmm.
There's another, so just reference, is there any thoughts about just referencing it instead of having another definition?
Where do you have it defined? Where are you thinking it's defined?
I have it in my work laptop, but there's no way about what credentialing.
Standards, organ accrediting bodies and stuff. Somebody has defined it.
Right. I'm thinking of
PH1, number 5 under definitions.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah. I mean, we defined it here. Did we point to a statute? Because we would have in that sense.
They defined that in Senate Bill 507, Melissa. With the 90-day turnaround time, did they define credentialing? I don't know. I'm just throwing that out there.
Right.
That's an earlier bill.
Yeah. I'll do a double check. Because it was 2014 when we first came together. Yeah, please do. Because if they are, I think we'd rather reference that. I remember doing an analysis of what credentialing is and like having to define it because I couldn't find anything.
I think I remember. I have something on my spell sheet.
Okay.
Laptop.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Let's see, where were we? So we're going to move on to past health system. I still have some concerns about the delegated credentialing agreement area, so that number 5 on page 5, a little bit lower than the middle of the page. The goal really here is delegation agreements were left out of the statute, but they weren't left out on purpose. And because there's a lot of delegating going on and some confusion as to how it interacts with this program in, you know, a future state once implemented, the DOJ has suggested, it was like a year and a half ago or something, we need to define how delegation agreements should be used. And I'm in agreement with that, but I want to make sure that we capture these goals. And I wrote these two goals. Basically, ensure that the delegator gets the information and verification from the system to avoid duplication and credentialing. So we don't want them to go out and get the information again if we already have it. Because the primary purpose of this was to reduce administrative burdens on providers, but to also reduce duplication in the system and credentialing. However, what I don't want to do is preclude folks from going out and doing additional verification if that verification does not meet their specific needs. And I don't think that was the intention of the statute either. So an example of that would be, again, the work history. If we verify work history and it's a static piece of information, it doesn't change, you entered your employment, it's not going to change, we verify it. But some folks' standards are that it needs to be verified within 90 days of going to committee or something. I don't want to stop them from doing that additional verification. I don't think that was the statute's intention. The statute was, if it's in there and you can use it, we need to use it. If your standards are above and beyond, we don't really want to get in the way of that. We would like you to come and use the system, but you can do that additional verification. Even though to me it doesn't make that much sense, but. So those are the goals that I have in mind when trying to write something about delegation agreements. And so the best I have thus far, and even in getting information from DOJ, is this. So it's delegated credentialing agreements, and I call it that instead of delegation agreements because that's how it was defined before in telemedicine rules. So delegated credentialing agreements between credentialing organizations may be used to the extent that they do not include the collection of credentialing information and verifications available in the OCCP system.
Melissa, this is Danielle.
Yes.
So with what you said, to me, isn't necessarily with that statement. To me, that statement says, if I've delegated, like, for THA, they credential people for 12 other health plans, so they've delegated credentialing, and that's between two credentialing organizations, that the delegated people who have delegated THA can't ask THA for copies of the primary source verification because they could just get that from the system. They're just trying to circumvent that way. That's what I feel this sentence talks about. But if you're trying to talk about the system not limiting us of getting it out of the program, I guess when you say between credentialing organizations, delegated agreements between that, I see it from a CO to a CO, not the CO to the program. Or like if I use a CBO, then CBO gets it out of there.
Right, no.
Did I miss something that you were talking about?
Yeah, this should be a credentialing organization to credentialing organization. You're interpreting that differently?
Well, I guess when you were talking about it, it seemed like maybe I kept it too general in my mind. So it might just be me.
So what about the situation for, should CBO be in this language? So if you use a CBO for the collection and verification of information, but you're making the decision, so it's a partially delegated agreement, we would still say if that information is collected and verified through our system, you know, that would,
I guess, Melissa, are you considering a CBO a credentialing organization?
No.
Okay. So this, because your comment box talks about CBOs.
Right. And that's a good point brought up, because I had another thought along that line, and that's you may still want a CBO to do work for you. So there is a case where there's a CBO and a credentialing organization is delegating to them, and they have basically said, I don't care what you do, I don't want to touch the system, I want my CBO to continue to do it. So they are acting still on behalf of that organization, and they could be signed up basically as a sub-user on that credentialing organization's account. So in that sense, they would still be delegating the information collection and verification, but having it go through OHA for the information that's in there on certain practitioners. So I don't want to stop that ability either. Does that make sense to you?
It does. I'm just trying to figure out if you're wanting to add more language to number five with what you're talking about. Because right now you're just talking about between credentialing organizations. So I guess my question to you is, are you asking if we should expand the language of number five, or you don't want to expand the language of number five?
Right. I think we can if it makes something more clear, if it flushes out the issues and gets, you know, doesn't impede those goals. I think definitely more language, if it makes it clear to simplify the language and make it shorter in some way, then I'll be it. I am asking you for your suggestion on language here, keeping those goals in mind. And we don't have to do that today. I mean, that's something that I really need in the next week.
So this is just strictly about delegation agreements, but the previous term on page 4, section 15, number 1, is our basic term saying credentialing organizations, you know, have to get information from the system to the, you know, if the information is kept and maintained in the system. That's at its base, but the later point is just to call out what the expectation is for delegation.
Right. So I think the important thing is everyone clear on the intent at this point?
Yeah, well, so the intent is that I can't just get out of not using the program, that I could just delegate stuff to Anne at Providence and say, just give me copies of what you download.
Right.
Okay. And Danielle, that's actually how we've been interpreting it, is we feel, we at Providence, at least at the health plan, feel that the way we're kind of interpreting it is the fact that we can't use it as a way to go behind the system so that, like, we get out of, you know, paying all these fees or whatever, that
right.
We can't say, hey, just give us a copy of what you got, and thanks for doing the work on our behalf.
Right.
And that's how I read, and I guess that, yeah, but I want to make sure that it doesn't, it's not language to limit us that we have to use the verifications that are in there, that we don't have the ability to get updated ones if we feel per our policies that they're outdated and wouldn't be relevant
right.
in a current evaluation.
Right.
Right.
Or that we have to wait, because if someone puts their OPCA up there and we're giving the system 30 days to credential them, you know, an organization could have resources to get it done. If they're able to download just the OPCA the moment it's available, they could get it done in a day if it's like a health plan and it's really quick. So I just want to make sure we don't have to wait for the verifications that are in there and that we're not limited to only using what is in there.
Right. And so I think that's, you know, the issue is, so to the extent of if it's available in the system, so if it's not available, yes, you can go out and get it. But again, that second bullet there, we didn't want to prohibit additional verification. That's exactly your point.
Yeah.
So as long as everyone's clear on intent, then hopefully folks can provide some commentary or suggestions within the next week. I can do some further digging in it, and when I have a sit down with the DOJ, I'll go flesh that out a little bit. It would be helpful to have your comments and suggestions. Okay. Moving right along. Okay, under healthcare practitioner, number six, I wanted to, well, actually we'll start at number five because that's where I pulled in the fee. So healthcare practitioners shall pay a one-time application fee to the authority due at initial application submittal. So that is the fee piece. The actual fee is in the fee section. But that's the practitioner requirement. Let's see. Then number six, I just wanted to point out I haven't had the chance to get someone to confirm this language, but the idea was that for a petition of hardship or waiving from the electronic submittal of information, so for those practitioners that may experience a hardware service constraint or physical impairment and need to use a paper process, that they have to apply for a waiver. And we wanted to look at doing a form for someone to fill out. So instead of having them write a letter saying it should contain all of these things, the suggestion from you guys was to do a form and have basically those fields in there and they could just fill them out. So that's what this language is all about. So if you look at the end of six, it's the authority shall A, provide a petition form on the program's website, and B, review approved waivers at least every 2 years for validity. Any comments about that?
Makes sense.
Okay. If we move on to use of healthcare practitioner information, we are still working on this piece as well, but we do have to identify what general information is in our rule and statute, because it just says except for general information used for directories, all information is exempt from public disclosure. So we have created a list here, but essentially the DOJ is not entirely comfortable with that. I think they needed more information as to what we want to use it for and how we want to use it. And again, that intention is to use it for OHA's provider directory.
Let me ask
Melissa, there is an NCQA, it's not a credentialing standard, I believe it's a, they call it an RR standard, but they list things that health plans should be listing in a directory. I don't know if that would be helpful for you to know what those are in describing that here.
It might be. I mean, we have all our provider directory work, but that's like super comprehensive. I wonder if it's more succinct for an, you know, out of the credentialing system. Can you get a hold of that?
I can see if I can with our NCQA manager, see if she would be able to give us that standard language.
Melissa, I actually have access to the standard. I can get it to you.
There you go, Anne.
Mark, you had a comment?
No, I'm just interested to know what standards exist out there and if the medical board follows any particular standard either on that. Because I know you don't list on the website, like location, for privacy reasons.
Right. We follow the public records exemptions for, so everything that we have is public information. The only things that we can refuse to disclose are things that fall under an exemption from public records. So personal information, investigatory information, those are big ones. Health information.
Right, and directory data, there's all sorts of standards for provider directory data. And so we have an entire listing of that, and that's actually fairly comprehensive, and it includes facilities. But the general idea is these few things, so name, specialty, practice location, and practice affiliation. But there are all sorts of other things in this standards and that are now, they're reaching out to things like, you obviously have location, office hours, and accepting new patients. Those types of things are also being included in new regulations for provider directories. So there's a whole other group that we have that's working on those pieces. But in general, from credentialing data, what can we expect that most organizations use or need? And that's what we've identified at a high level.
So I guess for me, it begs the question under, talks about general information, then it talks about public disclosure of general information may be done for a set fee. Who is anticipated as the purchaser of that?
So that's it. Well, again, the intention is that we don't want to be giving the data out to everybody who, you know, asks us. But if it's public disclosure, it's public disclosure. And so really the idea is that we need to make sure that we charge for the use of that information if we have to be disclosing it. And I can think of there may be other directories out there that want to establish a centralized directory, thinking of LexisNexis, pulling public data from every source in the nation, and then they're selling it to other organizations. So we just don't want to get in the business of having multiple continuous regular extracts of the information. So these are protective clauses, I would say. And that would be what we could see that somebody might be wanting to get the data from us for.
Well, this is Bill Donlin. You brought up the point before about the concerns about what is credentialing versus what is privileging, this and that. Now we're talking about directories. I don't think directories have anything to do with credentialing, and that's what we're here to discuss.
Right. Well, it actually does. Because in the statute, it basically says that all information that is used for this program is exempt from public disclosure except directory-related data. And so that's what we're trying to define here. And it says the general information used for directory is the exact clause.
I hear you.
So that's where we get into this territory, unfortunately.
Yeah, problem.
There are options. Can you go the other direction and say instead of what will be available in a directory, what cannot go in a directory?
That's a thought. I think that's much more expansive, actually.
Oh, okay.
Or a kind of general, oh, any sort of medical information, personal information.
Right.
Thrown out the other.
Sorry. So are we still waiting on DOJ chiming in on this?
Yeah, I have to have a more pointed conversation. Yeah, so I did note that, so this section is still under review by the DOJ. So. Okay, so more to come there. And then finally, we have the imposition of fees, and that's section 70 on page 8. And so this is where we list out the specific fees. Recommended we do it this way and then adding our table into the rule. So number one is credentialing organization, and then there is a healthcare practitioner piece, number two on the top of page 9. And then the other section that I wanted to point out that we're still working on is number 3 is the public records request fees. We basically just stole medical board information here, but we actually have to tie it to what would be our cost of furnishing this, and there's public record laws in terms of how much you can charge for public record data. We'll just be fleshing that out a little bit further. So I wanted to show you that we have that in there.
In the information when you actually kind of file these rules, will the justification for this and the actual cost of the state be clarified in them?
No. But it has to be available if someone asks, essentially.
Melissa, this is Melanie.
Yes.
I have a question on number 2 under the $150 per practitioner fee.
Yes.
Does that need any specificity regarding annual one-time fee?
No, where that piece is under the healthcare practitioner requirement. That is on page... That's on page 6, number 5. So it says healthcare practitioners shall pay a one-time application fee to the authority due at initial application submittal. So that's where that piece is.
Got it. Thank you.
Yeah. And these are just the amounts in here. Other than that, there's nothing else new here. So at this point, I would ask if anybody has any other comments in relation to these rules. Otherwise, we can move to see if there's any. Do we mute public participants?
We did.
Okay, we can open up.
You want to go to the next
slide? Anyone else?
On this last page 9, number 4, all program fees are non-refundable and non-transferable. So if you decide that I include language where if it doesn't at the end of the year.
Right, we do a rebalance or whatever. Okay, so we'll have that conversation internally and I'll make sure we flag that piece of it too if we do anything.
Okay. Right, public.
Anyone else?
So will we get, you want comments?
To place all all participants are now in interactive talk mode.
Prior to them, maybe, on the DOJ, what they're looking at?
Probably not. What we can do is we have to push this out to the advisory group to make sure they have an opportunity to see new changes so we can push this out to you at that time as well. And then please remember that it's a notice of proposed rule. There's still opportunity for input, and there will be a public hearing. So there's a public comment period for 21 days, and then we have the hearing, and then we compile everything and finalize the rules and then file a final. So we'll have through most of August as well. So still a month and a half out yet for public comment. Okay, folks on the phone, public participants, does anyone have a comment or question? Anyone going once? All right. It looks like we are going to conclude our rules meeting. So please, folks, if you have comments, check in with the committee by June 30th, and we can. I'll go ahead and send out when we send the rules out to the advisory group. I can also copy them through.
And Melissa, do you want us to respond to you by the 30th, right?
Yes.
Or before?
Okay. By the 30th or before.
And there's one that you'd like back for a week.
Yeah.
If you had an idea. If it was one.
Delegation.
Yeah.
That would be nice. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Thanks, Melissa.
Thank you all.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye.